ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I just lost it. I started screaming. Called my husband. He was like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" I said, "My dad and brothers go."
As recovery teams sort through the wreckage of the Los Angeles fires, they're only beginning to get a sense of what has been lost.
For Monday, January 13th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly, assessing the impact these fires will have on California's home insurance market, which was already in crisis.
We were told that nobody was insuring renters up this way, so we just had no choice.
Also, how TikTok users are responding to the looming U.S. ban on the app.
I think they're being unfairly singled out. There's apps like Shein and Temu that I promise you are probably doing just as much.
And what could happen under the next Trump presidency to the thousands of workers here without legal status who helped the government investigate labor violations?
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The largest of the fires burning in Los Angeles, the Palisades Fire, is now at 14% containment. But as Steve Futterman reports, the biggest concern right now is increased winds over the next 48 hours.
Los Angeles is a city on edge. The new winds have arrived. Stronger Santa Ana winds are coming. And residents are being warned the next couple of days could be dangerous.
We're not in the clear. I want to make sure of that. We are not in the clear as of yet.
LA City Fire Chief Kristen Crowley.
We must not let our guard down, as we have right now extreme fire behavior.
The strongest winds are expected on Tuesday and Wednesday. Fire crews and engine companies have been strategically pre-positioned in areas where new fires could start, or where previously extinguished fires could reignite. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Confirmation hearings for President-elect Donald Trump's nominees get underway this week on Capitol Hill. Tomorrow, controversial military vet and Fox News host Pete Hegseth goes before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Trump nominated him to be defense secretary. But as NPR's Domenico Montanaro reports, he's facing questions about sexual misconduct and financial mismanagement and about positions he's taken regarding military policy.
Hegseth's hearing is going to probably be the one that's the most closely watched because of all the controversy around him. That includes whether women should be in combat, for example, and he's likely to face some tough questioning from several senators, including Democrat Tammy Duckworth from Illinois, who lost both of her legs in the Iraq War.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro reporting. Also beginning the vetting process this week, Doug Burgum for Secretary of the Interior. President Biden is publicly calling on the incoming Trump administration to carry forward two of his priorities, artificial intelligence and clean energy. NPR's Asma Khalid reports his comments came during a farewell speech at the State Department about his foreign policy legacy.
President Biden sees these two issues as key to shaping the future of the world, and he had some sharp words for those in the next administration who have been skeptical about the clean energy transition.
They don't even believe climate change is real. I think they come from a different century. They're wrong. They are dead wrong.
Biden said China is trying to dominate the clean energy market and the U.S. can't allow that to happen. The other big priority he's calling on the next administration to continue is around artificial intelligence. He says the U.S. needs to make sure it remains in the lead and should not offshore the technology. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Asian markets are trading mixed at this hour. The Nikkei in Japan down 1.5%. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong up 0.5%. This is NPR. Scientists in Canada are investigating whether bacteria can be programmed to break down plastics. As Michigan Public's Lester Graham reports, pieces and fibers of plastic that end up in wastewater plants can pass through into streams and rivers.
Using what's known as bacterial sex, a team at Ontario's University of Waterloo engineered bacteria often found in wastewater plants to try to break down plastics. In one lab experiment, the bacteria degraded 40% of a plastic cup lid in 4 days. PhD candidate Aaron Yip is one of the researchers.
My hope is that this technology can be a platform to get rid of microplastics in different types of environments, so wastewater treatment plants being one of them, and perhaps in the far future in the oceans or lakes.
Yip says the next step is to determine what's left behind after bacteria destroy the plastic and whether it or the bacteria pose a risk to the environment. For NPR News, I'm Lester Graham.
Blue Origin called off its debut launch of a massive new rocket because of technical trouble. The uncrewed 320-foot New Glenn rocket was supposed to blast off early this morning with a prototype satellite from Cape Canaveral, Florida. But launch controllers faced an unspecified problem with the rocket in the final minutes of the countdown and called it off. The test flight already had been delayed by rough seas that posed a risk to the company's plan to land the first stage booster on a floating platform in the Atlantic. Blue Origin didn't immediately set a new launch date for the rocket named after astronaut John Glenn. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles, standing on the front porch of my house here, where I have been standing every morning, assessing the color of the sky as if it offers some inkling on whether I can feel less shaky, less jittery each day. I have watched these skies go from the color of gray dishwater to a light blue this morning, almost the kind of blue sky that draws so many people to this city by the ocean. And it's like the sky is telling me things are going back to normal. But I know very deeply that they are not. For thousands and thousands of people, the struggle has only begun. I mean, everyone in this county has heard of someone, has a friend whose home has been decimated, whose entire life has been upended. And every time you hear of one tragic story, your brain tries to multiply that out by thousands and thousands, and you just cannot compute the depth and breadth of that loss. And you can't help but think to yourself, what if you lost everything? What would you do? How would you begin?
Elsa, we do know that as officials sift through the wreckage of these wildfires, they are getting a better sense of what has been lost. We know the flames have destroyed thousands of homes and buildings and cars.
And at least 24 people have lost their lives, a number that is likely to rise. Anthony Mitchell and his son Justin Mitchell are two of the victims. Anthony's daughter, Hajmi White, says both used wheelchairs, and they were waiting to be evacuated from their Altadena home when White last spoke to her dad.
And he told me that he loved me and everything. And before we get on the phone, he said, baby, I gotta go. He said, a fire just made it in the yard.
The fire just made it in the yard. A few hours later, she got a call telling her her dad and her brother had both died in the blaze.
Right there, I just lost it. I started screaming, hollering at my husband. He was like, what's wrong? What's wrong? I said, my dad and brother's gone.
White says she remembers her father as someone who would do anything for family.
And he always tell me, I'll do anything for you, baby. He said, whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do it. He said, you tell me to jump, I'm going to say hi, hi, and I'm going to jump.
She pointed to the fact that her dad, despite his own ailments, continued to care for his son, Justin, who had cerebral palsy.
Oh, wow. Justin, my dad would tell him, he'd say, Haji on the phone, tell Haji hi. He would try his best to tell me hi. And my dad would say, tell Haji you love her. He'd be like, he'd be trying to tell me he loved me.
White says she's still trying to comprehend the gravity of what she's lost. She says she will always carry with her a reminder of her dad.
Because when I look in the mirror, I see my dad. I look like my dad and my mom, but I know my dad is with me because I look just like him and I have features of him.
That is Hajmi White, who lost her father, Anthony Mitchell, and her brother, Justin Mitchell, in the Eaton fire.
We're going to turn to a story, another one about Altadena, to the 24-year-old amateur climatologist whom some locals are calling a neighborhood hero because he warned them early about the approaching risk of wildfire, and he urged them to be ready to evacuate. Edgar McGregor is the leader of the Altadena Weather and Climate Group on Facebook. He joins us now. Edgar, thank you so much from all of us here in Los Angeles. I just want to say I'm so glad that you're safe, first of all.
I'm so glad that I'm safe and my home is standing, honestly.
So I just want to explain to everyone why you are being called a hero right now. I mean, before the Eaton fire broke out last week, you were already warning people in your Facebook group to begin making early preparations to evacuate, like locating important documents, turning their cars to face out of the driveway. What were the specific warning signs for you that led you to believe we got to take these winds really seriously right now?
Well, I think all of this really started back in May of last year. We saw one last rainstorm here in Southern California, and the mountains were lush, all sorts of plants and moss on the trees, everything was bright green. And if you've lived in Southern California for a long time, you know that it doesn't rain here during the summer and the autumn months. And so all that fuel is going to dry out. Unfortunately, this autumn, we didn't see any rainfall return. It usually does so by November or December. And when the winds were appeared in the forecast around New Year's Day, I knew that if a wildfire were to break out, it would not be pretty.
Right. And when you saw a fire had indeed broken out in Eaton Canyon, near where you are, What was your first thought? Bring me back to that moment.
Well, my first thought was, where was it exactly? Because I was hoping that it was right next to homes and that the fire wouldn't be able to get a lot of steam before it hit the neighborhoods. I was hoping it wouldn't be up in the mountains, because if it were up in the mountains, it could burn an enormous amount of brush and get really hot and build a fire front before it hit the homes. And unfortunately, it was in a location where we actually see wind tunneling, where winds are squeezed as they go through the canyons of Southern California. We saw winds of 70 miles an hour that night. And when I got the location of where the fire began, I knew this was not going to be good.
Yeah. Well, your Facebook group now is just full of stories from people who say that they are alive, that they made it out early enough because of you and the warnings that you were issuing to everyone. Is there one story from someone that stands out to you?
I think one of the stories that I there's so many of them, honestly. I've been doing my best to read them, but one story was of a woman who looked at my forecast and said, you know what, I'm not even going to be in town for this. I don't want to be there during the winds. I don't want to be there if a wildfire breaks out. And she packed up her and her kids, and they went rented a motel somewhere down south, and they weren't even here. Those children were spared of the trauma of evacuating from a fire. And so it's not just, you know, that I'm helping saving lives or anything, but it's helping remove those fears from those children's lives that they simply don't need.
Right. So I have to ask you, I mean, as someone who wants to warn people of incoming danger, how do you balance keeping people informed of what you perceive as a very real mass threat without causing mass panic? I mean, were you a little worried that maybe you were being a little too, you know, panicky?
Well, the difficult job here was not standing in the middle of the street at 6:30 p.m. that night, telling everybody to get out as the mountains behind me were on fire. The difficult task was spending 3 years building trust in my community, whereby that when I made a forecast, people could be confident that that would come true. And I would never use the word extreme or cataclysmic or generational or anything like that, because when the conditions were right, I needed people to hear my words when I said run.
And so many needed them to run. Edgar McGregor leads the Altadena Weather and Climate Group on Facebook. Thank you so much, Edgar.
Thank you for having me.
Immigration is always in the news. Late last week, President Biden extended temporary protected status for folks from Venezuela, El Salvador, and Ukraine. And incoming, President Trump has vowed to implement mass deportations, among other things. Just as the stories are ever evolving, so too is the language we use to talk about them. NPR recently changed its guidance on how we reporters talk about this issue on our air and in pieces for our website. Tony Cavan is NPR's managing editor of Standards and Practices, and he is here now to walk us through some of the new guidance. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Marian Elise.
So I want to share with everybody the lead of the email that you sent to all staff, landed in my inbox this morning. It begins, quote, "When referring to people who are in the United States without the government's permission, going forward, we should use the term people who are in the United States without legal status," end quote. Tony Cavan, what's the thinking here?
Well, two things. I noticed that our own guidance was contradictory about the use of the term undocumented, mm-hmm. both approving it and not approving it. I just think something didn't get updated, so I knew it was time to do something. And I also noticed that the Associated Press had stopped using undocumented as a description for people who are here without the government's permission. Many of the people do have documents. They don't have the right documents. The trick here is finding language that is both clear, that doesn't dehumanize the people we're talking about, and makes the point in as exact a way as possible, and we're not somehow coloring the debate by the language that we use.
I want to talk about one other term that has been used in our coverage, plenty of news organizations have used in past, illegal immigrants. And for people listening who may be scratching their heads and thinking, okay, but there are folks who come to the U.S. illegally, your note says, NPR journalists, we can use the term illegal immigration, not illegal immigrants. The distinction being what?
That people are not illegal. Someone can do something that's illegal, but they are not in and of themselves illegal.
Okay.
So we don't want to do that.
This is trying to center just basic humanity in our coverage of the people
exactly.
that we're writing about?
You know, I also mentioned in the same note that we try not to use terminology that talks about national phenomena when we're in a flood of immigrants or waves of immigrants, just because you lose the humanity. Each one of these people who comes to this country, no matter whether they entered legally or illegal, there's a story behind it. There's an individual story. Our job is to try and get as close to those stories as possible.
That gets to a kind of golden rule of thumb in journalism, which is generally better to use a description than a label. Give us an example or two that come to mind here.
Well, for example, we should say someone had crossed the border without permission, or he stayed in the U.S. after his tourist visa expired. It really varies on the individual, but to the extent we can describe a situation, it's always better than labeling that situation. And as you note, that's not exclusive to immigration.
That is NPR Managing Editor Tony Cavan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. It's far too early to say how expensive the fires in Los Angeles will be in terms of homes lost, but some estimates have it at more than $20 billion. Whatever the final number, it will have a huge impact on California's home insurance market, which was already in crisis. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
In Altadena, Quinn Perry visited her home this weekend for the first time since the fire. It's now just ashes and rubble.
This was our bedroom. There's our bed. My antique bed.
It's now a blackened, twisted ruin. Perry and her family leased the home and always had renter's insurance to cover the expense of relocation and replacing their possessions. That is, until last year.
We were told that nobody was insuring renters up this way, so we just had no choice.
With no insurance, her family's relying on FEMA and a GoFundMe page. In recent years, insurance companies have begun using sophisticated computer modeling and artificial intelligence to calculate risk in fire-prone areas. Janet Ruiz with the Insurance Information Institute says that led several companies to stop writing new policies for homeowners and renters in places like Altadena and Pacific Palisades.
They did have to restrict coverage so that when we have catastrophes such as the one in Los Angeles, they can pay claims.
California law requires insurance companies to hold reserves adequate to pay out claims even in a catastrophe such as these fires. For that reason, Dave Jones, former California insurance commissioner, says he wouldn't expect this event will push any companies into insolvency.
It will be an earnings event for them, as they say in the industry, which means they won't make profits this year for sure.
Homeowners will also have to help pay for the fires. Because insurance companies stopped writing new policies in these areas, many homeowners were forced to purchase coverage from California's FAIR plan. Often called the insurer of last resort, it's a plan created by the state and funded by the industry. Jones says so many homes in Pacific Palisades had coverage from FAIR that it may run out of money. If that happens, the plan will impose a special assessment on home insurance policyholders statewide. Also, under new regulations recently adopted in California, insurance companies are able to use their computer modeling risk analysis to set higher rates, something that previously wasn't allowed.
There's no question that before these wildfires, they have been and were going to raise rates more. Now with these wildfires, they're going to be able to ask for even higher rate increases.
Those new regulations also require insurance companies to continue to write new policies in fire-prone areas. Last week, California's insurance commissioner issued a moratorium that prevents insurance companies from canceling or not renewing policies in the affected areas for the next year. But Amy Bach with United Policyholders, a consumer group, worries these catastrophic fires will set back efforts to bring insurance companies back to the market in places like Pacific Palisades and Altadena.
You know, just psychologically, this disaster couldn't have come at a worse time in terms of insurance executives' renewed confidence in doing business in this state.
In Altadena, that's bad news for Perry Bennett. He owns the building in Altadena that was home to the Little Red Hen, a coffee shop that now is just a slab and ashes.
Getting insurance on the Little Red Hen was very difficult because of what just happened. I think it's going to be very, very difficult. Even if you build back, it's going to be difficult to get insurance, or it's going to be really expensive.
Bach, the consumer advocate, has another concern. People who may have decided to drop their insurance coverage.
For some people, you know, certainly like lower income people who are living in a home they inherited, they may have just said, I'm priced out. I can't afford, you know, $10,000 a year or $15,000 a year or what have you.
As the cost of insurance continues to rise, Bach and others worry that more people will be tempted to drop their coverage. Greg Allen, NPR News, Los Angeles.
It it is time to talk about books. Yay! There are a whole lot of new books coming out in the next couple of months. And here to highlight some fiction picks is Andrew Limbong. He hosts NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Hi.
Hey, Mary Louise. Yay, indeed.
Yay,
let's do
indeed.
It.
Indeed. All right, let's start with the big one, the one that we know we're going to be hearing all about. There is a new Hunger Games book about to come out. Tell me.
Uh-huh, exactly. Yeah, this one is set to come out in March. There's not a lot known about it, to be honest. In true Suzanne Collins fashion, she's keeping pretty tight-lipped, and, you know, I haven't gotten my hands on a copy. But here's what we do know. It's another prequel, and it's set 24 years before the start of the first Hunger Games book. And we know that Collins was actually inspired by the Scottish philosopher David Hume. When the book was announced, she said she was inspired by his ideas of implicit submission, you know, how many are governed by the few. And I guess we'll know more once it comes out.
Wow. Hunger Games meets 18th century Scottish philosophy. Okay.
Yeah.
What about something that you have gotten your hands on that you have read and loved and that we should all look forward to?
All right. I think there are two books that are actually kind of related that I want to shout out. The first is called Dream State, and it's by Eric Puchner. And it starts with this guy who is getting married and is having his college best friend officiate. Except what happens is the best friend ends up marrying the fiance.
Oh.
The book follows this sort of like three-way relationship across decades. And it's this real interesting meditation on marriage and on like male friendships and the sort of like what ifs in life. You know, it's like, oh, what if I married this other person or took that other job? And, you know, things like that. And that book comes out in February. The other book I want to shout out is Tilt by Emma Patti. It's this really tight and fast-paced thriller about a woman pregnant. At the start of the book, she's at IKEA looking for a crib when an earthquake erupts. And the book sort of follows her way across Portland, and she has to decide, you know, who to help and who to leave behind as she sort of tries to survive this disaster zone.
Those both sound really good, but I'm going back to, I'm still stuck on, you said they were related? How are they related?
Yeah. What's interesting is how they both treat climate change. You know, I don't know if I'd necessarily turn them as like quote unquote cli-fi, right? Because they're not like about climate change, but the climate definitely plays a huge part in these characters' lives, right? In Tilt's case, the author is actually a climate journalist. That's her background. And so all of the stuff in the book that's about, you know, not just the disaster itself, but the disaster response is pretty grounded in research. And in Dream State, a lot of it takes place in Montana, and all the quiet domestic drama stuff plays out while like the characters are constantly checking the air quality index, you know, and like going indoors because like the smoke makes it hard to breathe. Like, it's not subtle, you know, I wouldn't call it subtext, but it's also not just the topic at hand, right? And so, you know, obviously these books are written before the fires in California, but it shows you that the writers are really trying to deal with and respond to the climate crisis as it's going on.
What about international fiction? Any exciting books coming out overseas?
Yeah, in 2021, Abdulrazak Gurnah won the Nobel Prize in Literature. He's based in England now, but he was born and raised in Zanzibar and writes a lot about colonialism and refugees. And in March, he's coming out with the first book that he's written since he won the Nobel. It's titled Theft. It's about these two young people who take in a poor boy to take care of. Obviously, you can tell from the title, Theft, there's some misplaced of trust that occurs and turns everything topsy-turvy. And all of this takes place in Tanzania during a time where, like, tourism is popping off, technology is booming, and just the culture is mixing and shifting in a really rapid way.
And here's Andrew Limbong with some fiction picks there to get us through the winter. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
This is NPR News. A new opera imagines two black women politicians competing to become Houston's new mayor. Hear from some of the creatives trying to change what opera looks and sounds like tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
That's all things considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. This week marks the midway point for January.
What happens if you're already way off target for all those ambitious New Year's resolutions?
Just remind yourself that you have a couple free passes. If you have a late night at work, you can take a mulligan and it's okay.
Resetting resolutions after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Los Angeles County District Attorney has announced felony charges against 9 people for burglary or looting in areas affected by the ongoing wildfires here. NPR's Martin Costi reports authorities are promising to crack down on anyone caught taking advantage of the situation.
L.A. County Sheriff Robert Luna says high-profile reports of opportunistic burglaries in fire-affected areas have preyed on the minds of residents.
People are saying, hey, this is the reason I don't want to evacuate. I don't want to be victimized again. This is a strong message from all of us that we are here, and when we catch people, we mean business.
The National Guard has bolstered police checkpoints leading into evacuated areas in Altadena and the Pacific Palisades, making it harder to get in. Sheriff Luna says he doesn't yet have statistics on reports of thefts in those areas, but those numbers may come in once residents are allowed back to check their homes. Martin Costi, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The U.S. Supreme Court says it won't block a lawsuit in Hawaii that aims to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for damages caused by climate change. As NPR's Michael Copley tells us, dozens of similar cases have been filed against the oil and gas industry.
Honolulu is suing fossil fuel companies in state court for allegedly misleading the public about the dangers their products pose to the Earth's climate. Honolulu says it's suffering as a result from things like flooding and more extreme storms and heat waves. Oil companies argued the emissions causing climate change are a national matter, and that lawsuits like Honolulu's belong in federal court. The Supreme Court's decision not to hear the industry's appeal allows Honolulu's case to move forward. An industry group called the American Petroleum Institute said it's disappointed by the decision, and that climate change is an issue for Congress to deal with, not the courts. Michael Copley, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. Voters in Lebanon are celebrating that they finally have a president and appointed prime minister after more than 2 years without an elected government there. NPR's Emily Fang reports from Beirut.
A small but jubilant crowd gathered in what's called Martyr Square in Beirut, the site of massive anti-government protests back in 2019. Those protests sought to strengthen state institutions in transparency in a country beset by corruption and sectarian fighting. Now the same protesters are back, celebrating the election last week of Joseph Aoun as president as a win for rule of law and bureaucratic reform. 24-year-old Adam Abouazedin was among those celebrating.
We know that Joseph Aoun took procedures to protect the judiciary and to protect the investigation of the Beirut port explosion.
The massive Beirut port explosion in 2020, for which no one was ever held to account. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beirut.
The annual Oscar nominations are being postponed at least a week as the Southern California wildfires continue to burn. The Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences is extending its voting period for members through Friday and has canceled its nominee luncheon. The Oscar nominations will now be announced on January 23rd, and the ceremony is still scheduled, though, for March 2nd. On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed today, the Dow up more than 350 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Ailsa Chang in Culver City, California. With Donald Trump returning to the White House, there are a lot of questions about what will happen to people who are in the country illegally. Will there be mass deportations? What about the Dreamers? Then there are the thousands of workers here illegally who have been helping the government enforce the law. NPR's Andrea Hsu has their story.
At the Arriva Las Vegas Worker Center, Karin Martinez is opening envelope after envelope. She's going through a pile of 100 letters, each a notice from the U.S. government to come in for fingerprinting. The recipients are workers in construction and warehouses and other industries who are here illegally. It's the final step in getting them protection from deportation and authorization to work. Martinez says inside each envelope is a dream.
Oh, cada carta es un sueño.
A light at the end of the tunnel.
Es una luz al final del túnel.
The Worker Center has helped about 1,000 people without legal status through this process under a policy advanced by the Biden administration. Workers who've been victims of workplace abuse have been getting temporary protection from deportation and Social Security numbers in exchange for speaking out. The aim is to help under-resourced labor agencies go after unscrupulous employers. The program is known as Deferred Action for Labor Enforcement, or DALE. Martinez is a DALE recipient herself.
Sí, soy DALEra.
She used to work for a staffing agency whose founder is in jail awaiting sentencing for tax crimes. Now, one of the earliest to receive DALE protections in Las Vegas was this man.
Mi nombre es Rosario Ortiz.
Rosario Ortiz came to Las Vegas 21 years ago. He worked in a restaurant and as a handyman. Then, 7 years ago, he got a job with a painting company called Unforgettable Coatings. He realized there were problems starting with his first paycheck.
Me di cuenta que no me pagaron dos días de trabajo.
He says he hadn't been paid for 2 days of work and also wasn't getting overtime despite working 60-some hours a week. Turns out the company had been cited by the Labor Department 5 years earlier for illegal pay practices. Ortiz says his coworkers were mad, but also fearful. When they complained, he says they were told
que nosotros teníamos que estar agradecidos con el jefe.
They should be grateful. The boss even hired them, given they're undocumented. In 2019, a small group of them started talking with labor investigators. A federal court ordered the company to not intimidate employees. And after Biden came into office, the Worker Center asked that the workers be given protection from deportation so they could testify. The company's founder and CEO says there was no wrongdoing, but he agreed to pay more than $3.6 million in back wages and damages to nearly 600 workers across four states. Ortiz says getting protections under DALE has changed everything.
Mucho, mucho, muy fácil.
Life is much easier, he says. Employers look at you differently. You feel safe going places. He no longer worries he'll be deported and separated from his family. The case has inspired others to report their employers when their paychecks bounce, when safety measures are skipped, when they're threatened for complaining. The Worker Center's director, Bliss Requetrautz, says DALE is their shield. More and more, she hears workers say,
with this in hand, we're going to hold that employer accountable.
But with Trump's promise of an immigration crackdown, she wonders if that courage will hold. Late last year, the Worker Center stopped filing new DALE applications with the government, given the detailed personal information they contain.
Predominantly, there's fear of putting people in harm's way if the future of the program is in question.
Across the country, close to 8,000 workers had received DALE protections as of the end of October, according to the government. Rosario Ortiz is among those whose work authorization will expire under Trump.
Esa es la preocupación de todos ahorita.
It's everyone's concern at the moment, he says. He fears what will happen if the new administration discontinues the program.
Es cuando los patrones abusadores más van a abusar del trabajador.
This is when abusive employers will abuse workers the most, he says. As night falls, Karin Martinez, who's been opening envelopes all day, takes a break for something special. Work authorization cards have come in for a handful of people.
Tengo el del señor Flores, el señor Tomás.
Gracias.
Dreams now in hand, these people will have protection for the next 4 years. For more than 100 others, though, the Worker Center is still waiting, hoping theirs will arrive this week. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Las Vegas.
170 million Americans are on TikTok, but maybe not for much longer. The Supreme Court is set to decide whether the app will continue to be available in the U.S. or be banned in 6 days. To get a sense of how TikTokers are talking about this, let's bring in NPR's Bobby Allen. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Mary Louise.
The backdrop, please. Where did we stand on the TikTok ban?
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's in the hands of the Supreme Court. Last week, I went to the court for an emergency hearing on the TikTok ban. Lawyers for TikTok said shutting it down would suppress the free speech of millions, and the government said a ban must start because TikTok's China ties just make it too much of a security risk. It did appear that the majority of both liberal and conservative justices seemed quite skeptical that TikTokers' free speech should be prioritized over national security, and if the court upholds the law, Mary Louise, on Sunday, TikTok goes dark.
On Sunday. So how are TikTokers responding to that looming deadline?
Yeah, they're sharing all sorts of ideas on the platform, but it's, you know, not totally clear what will work until a ban actually goes into effect. Some are plotting ways to circumvent a possible ban, like using a virtual private network, a VPN, to get around it. Others are encouraging users to change their country to Canada to try to avoid it. Then there are TikTokers like Maddie Cameron in Orlando. She's a 31-year-old content creator. She says if Washington is so concerned with China-based apps, why haven't they acted on popular e-commerce platforms that also collect user data and, you know, and treat it the same way TikTok's being treated?
I think they're being unfairly singled out. There's apps like Shein and Temu that I promise you are probably doing just as much. And I agree with what they said in the hearing that if you're going to hold TikTok accountable, then you need to start holding those accountable.
Yeah, and Madeline Cameron, who calls herself a mommy vlogger, is telling her more than 1 million followers to use services that automatically repurpose TikToks as videos on YouTube. So that's what some are doing now.
Okay, so that's what some TikTokers are doing. What about the company itself? How is it preparing?
Yeah, they say they're expecting Apple and Google to remove the app from mobile stores on Sunday unless the Supreme Court steps in. TikTok is also expecting all of their web hosting services to be cut. The company, though, is stressing the impact a ban would have on the millions who use it, right? It's something that the TikToker I talked to, Madeline Cameron, said to me, too.
I know to some, this app is just a silly little app where people make videos and go viral and there's dog videos or cat videos or silly dances, but there's so many jobs at risk for this ban. Social media managers, social media talent agencies, marketing agencies, small businesses.
Yeah, Cameron says she will survive if TikTok is banned. But for some other creators on the platform, their livelihoods really depend on this. So obviously a fair amount of dread in that community right now.
And NPR's Bobby Allen. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Kimberly Godsey. Years ago, when Godsey was training to become a nurse practitioner, she was doing rounds with a physician named Joe Seibert. It was an average day until they visited one patient with nausea and abdominal pain. When the pair left the room, Seibert told Godsey the woman's diagnosis, terminal pancreatic cancer.
And it was at that point he did something I'd never seen a physician do before. He picked up the phone and called her husband and said, "Hey, I'm worried about your wife. Can you come up to the clinic?" And then he took it another step further. He scheduled her follow-up tests and consults. So when we went back into her room, to give her a diagnosis, she received the news with her loving husband by her side. And it was at that point, Dr. Seibert said to me, we're supposed to save lives, but eventually in your career, there will come a time when you can't save everybody. But what you can do is you can change how they experience it. That lesson has stayed with me every day. I hadn't heard from Dr. Seibert for years when one day at the end of my workday, I got a phone call. It was Dr. Seibert, and he said, hey, Kim, I just saw your mom. Are you coming to her appointment tomorrow? And I didn't have plans to come. And he said, you know, I'm worried about your mom. It would be nice if you could come to the appointment. So the following morning, I showed up, and sure enough, he diagnosed my mom with terminal pancreatic cancer. While it was the worst news, she received that diagnosis with all three of her loving children by her side. I take that lesson I learned from Dr. Seibert so many years ago into my personal life and into my professional life every day, because I've learned that it's the little things that we can do that actually can make a huge difference on how people experience life.
Kimberly Godsey of Monterey, California. A little more than a year after the diagnosis, Godsey's mom passed away. She says Joe Seibert will always hold a special place in her family's hearts. You can find more stories of unsung heroes at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today is January 13th. Dare I ask how your New Year's resolutions are going? Please tell me I'm not alone once again in setting big, ambitious goals for the new year, only to slip up by the time that mid-January rolls around. Well, before we throw in the collective towel, how about a restart? NPR's Life Kit host, Marielle Segata, is here with tips. Hey there.
Hey.
Hi. So let's just say, hypothetically, asking for a friend, you had this like big goal for New Year's and you have already stopped pursuing it. How do we get back on track?
Yeah, honestly, I'm surprised that anyone gets anything done in the first 2 weeks of January, right after the holidays, right? It's exhausting and yeah. Your wallet is exhausted too. So first of all, cut yourself a break.
Amen.
And yeah, along those lines, what often happens, the reason we stop going with a goal is because we're too rigid with ourselves. We talked to Katie Milkman. She's a professor at the Wharton School of Business, and she's researched what she calls the what the hell effect. So basically, you say you're going to go to the gym 5 times a week. You go a couple days, and then you miss one. And then you miss another one, and you say, what the hell? I've already failed. She says it's better to build in some flexibility and give yourself something called a free pass.
If you have a late night at work, you can take a mulligan and it's okay. You don't want to give yourself 5 free passes, but maybe 2.
Yeah, and if you miss a whole bunch of days or you just haven't gotten started on your goals at all, you can always just start over.
Yes, put me in camp, have not gotten going on my goals at all. But what you're saying, this is actually useful. This is a tip in and of itself. It's not too late. There is still time.
Yeah, because of the power of the fresh start, really. That's what New Year's is all about. I mean, it's not a magical day, but it's a day that we've all decided is the beginning of the year, or somebody a long time before me decided that, but it's the beginning of the year. It's when we make our goals. And Katie Milkman has researched this too. The start of a new month, a new week, can give us motivation to begin again on something like savings, for instance, or working out. The beautiful thing, I think, is that we get those every month, every week, every time the sun rises. Just pick one and get going.
Might one possibly helpful way to look at this be, maybe it's not all us. Maybe it's not our lives, our problems that are standing in the way of success. It is maybe the goal itself that is the problem.
Yeah, sometimes there are a lot of things that can stop us from getting started. One is that your goal is just too big. I remember when I interviewed Oliver Berkman, he wrote a book called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And he said, like, okay, what's a goal you have? I wanted to retile my kitchen floor. And he was like, that is just too big to put on a to-do list. You're never going to be able to get that checked off. You have to break it down into smaller tasks. Go to the tile store, pick out the tile, measure the kitchen, get an estimate. Those are all things that you can do. So if you do have a big goal, like be healthier or, you know, save more money, you should break that down into your weekly thing. What am I saving money on? And also keep in mind what you're saving money for, because like the values underneath your goals matter too.
What about the idea that we don't have to go it alone on keeping resolutions? I know you've been reporting on Life Kit about using accountability buddies. What's that?
Yeah, the buddy system, right? It's tried and true. It's a lot of people have used it for years to go running, for instance, or lift weights. They say, hey, meet me at 6 a.m. I'm not one of these people. and we'll go running together. And you know that you're going to show up because the other person is counting on you. You can use that to your advantage, right? Often we are more interested in pleasing other people than in pleasing ourselves. So this is a way to harness that and help each other. You don't have to do the same workout. You could meet for coffee after you each do your own thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be about working out. You can write a chapter of your book or, you know, a page of your book, whatever. And then your friend is applying to jobs. You can check in with each other once a week and say, what have you done towards your goal this week? What have you done? Give each other a pat on the back. It's just the community aspect of it that, and the accountability aspect of it that makes it work.
Marielle, you want to meet me for a run tomorrow, 6 a.m.?
Yeah, no. 6 p.m. maybe.
It was worth a shot. That is our Life Kit host, Marielle Segura. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Life Kit has more ideas to help you stick to your goals in 2025. You can find them at npr.org/lifekit.
The
The actress Leslie Charlson spent more than four decades on the ABC daytime drama General Hospital, playing the cardiologist Monica Quartermain. General Hospital is the longest-running scripted drama in the United States, and Charlson was one of its longest-tenured cast members. Charlson died yesterday at 79 years old. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has this appreciation.
Leslie Charlson broke into show business early in her life. Her first gig? A car commercial with her mom. Here she is describing her experience on set during an interview with the New York City talk show Something to Offer.
And all I had to do was just to pretend to be asleep in the back seat. And they had to say how nice the car rode and everything like that. And I just remember my mother turning around and saying, with a big smile, if you don't close your eyes, Leslie, you're never going to see 8 years old. Do it right now.
As she got older, Charlson got serious about her career. She told the talk show Something to Offer that as her acting ambitions grew, her mom warned her.
Don't think about it. And of course, if your mother says don't do that, that's all you want to do.
Charlson appeared in a string of TV roles in the 60s and 70s before landing the role of Monica Quartermain on General Hospital in 1977. During an appearance on Maurice Bernard's podcast, Charlson said her first day on the soap coincided with the death of Elvis Presley.
I remember tears coming down my cheeks as I was driving for the first time to the studio.
To make matters worse, she arrived to find the crew on strike. And as she told Bernard, nobody was particularly nice to her in the beginning.
There was another Monica before me, and she had been rather, I guess, rudely fired. And so I came into a kind of hostile environment.
But she nailed her role as Monica Quartermain, a razor-sharp cardiologist with an embattled personal life, full of marriage, divorce, heartbreak, and affairs.
Well, I'm very pleased to see that you're showing some sense, Monica.
About what?
About not moving out and that you and Alan Jr. are still here.
The hell we are. I am now leaving for the gatehouse with my son.
In her more than four decades in the role, Charlson played Quartermain as she undergoes many obstacles, including a breast cancer diagnosis.
I also have a career. I have a family. I seem to be like third on the list of priorities. I mean, who said you could do it all?
A man.
Right. Charlson earned four daytime Emmy nominations for General Hospital. She also appeared on shows like Dharma and Greg and NBC's Friends. She died on January 12th after a long illness. In a statement to NPR, close friend and entertainment journalist Rosemary Rossi called Charlson a soap opera icon. She said that, quote, her arms and heart were always open. Everyone who was ever in her orbit felt that. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org. From Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at cunard.com.